Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell is out, but I am here and we have got quite the show for you. I talk to Kashmir Hill of the New York Times about a bananas story. I got access to my secret consumer score. Now you can get yours too. This is a fascinating look at companies that are collecting data on you, and it is pretty surprising. You might get 400 pages, as well as a chat with Daniel Bader about the Amazon Echo Studio, Amazon's latest entry and a competitor in the premium smart speaker market. Plus, so much more. Stay tuned.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 107, recorded Thursday, November 7th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Privacy.com. Stop using the same card number everywhere. Use Privacy's virtual cards to protect your financial information. And get a free $5 credit that you can use on any online purchase just for signing up today. To learn more and sign up in under a minute, go to privacy.com/TNW. And by Ring Central. With Ring Central, you'll get everything you need in one place for your business communication needs. With all-in-one cloud, phone, video conferencing, and team messaging, staying connected has never been easier. Save with their holiday bundle offer and don't pay until 2020 when you go to ringcentral.com/TNW. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Micah Sargent, and as you can see, I am here alone today. Jason Howell is out, but we've still got a great show planned. And boy, this first one is a bit of a doozy. This conversation I'm very much looking forward to. We have Kashmir Hill here from the New York Times. And we are talking about a story that kind of I've seen all over my feeds. It is entitled, I Got Access to My Secret Consumer Score. Now you can get yours too. Hello, Kashmir. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, good to be here.
Yes, we are excited. I know the folks, these different agencies that are collecting our data, maybe are scrambling now that this has been put out there to try to figure everything out. Do you want to tell a little bit about what you've done, what you've gone through and found, and sort of, I think the big thing here that's even said in the article, you quote the Wall Street Journal in 2018. Most people have no inkling they even exist. They being these companies and services that are creating a consumer score for us. So what's this all about?
Right. Yeah. There's this, this industry of kind of secret consumer scores has been covered for probably the last decade, but many consumers just have no idea. It is, we kind of are using the term to describe lots of different companies that do various like ratings and rankings and scoring of consumers to determine who the most valuable customers are, or making sure that somebody's not a fraudster or shoplifter who's trying to, you know, rip off the business. And so there's lots of companies that do this. And for years, whenever journalists have written about them, they said, you know, this is a very secretive industry. You can't get your file. You can't find out what your score is. But I discovered that in the last few months that has started to change because of this new privacy law that's going to go into effect in California in 2020. A lot of these companies are getting prepared to actually share the data they have on consumers with those consumers. And even though I live in New York, I thought, hey, I'll just try to approach a few of these companies and see if they'll share my files with me. And to my great surprise, a couple of them did. And to my greater surprise, one of the companies named Sift sent me a 400-page file that had things I had ordered on Yelp years ago, like sog paneer, you know, garlic naan on a Saturday night in April of 2016. And then all of the messages I had sent on Airbnb, every time I had opened the Coinbase app and kind of why I was doing that. And then each of these kind of entries in my file had information about the device that I used to do whatever I was doing on whichever site.
I want to ask you, because I think that that will, if it do, if it didn't, it will, with the listeners out there, maybe result in a bit of a gasp. Like, they had that much information. How did you feel when you got back this 400 page file and you were sifting through? Like, was this a, I'm sure that there was a lot of emotion going on, but were you more on the side of, oh, I didn't remember that was there? Were you more on the side of, holy moly, this company has so much data on me? How were you feeling when you saw this?
I was more on the holy moly range of the spectrum. I mean, I was just shocked. I had no idea that a company beyond Airbnb had my Airbnb messages, or a company beyond Yelp knew what I was ordering on Yelp. Even though, you know, Sift is working on these companies' behalf, it's trying to make sure, it's essentially trying to protect me, you know, make sure that the person that's using my account to do something is actually me and not somebody who's taken it over. But still, I just was not expecting to get a file that large, and that they would have this much data on me, that they needed that much data on all of those companies' customers to do what they do.
Right. And what is it that Sift does specifically? I know that there were several companies that you covered, but what is Sift's job that makes them, or that not necessarily makes them, but gives them access to this? What are they doing for Airbnb, for Yelp, and for Coinbase here?
Yeah. So I've seen some people misinterpret the story, and they think that Sift like bought, you know, my messages from Airbnb or something like that. But the reason they have the data they have is that they've been hired by Airbnb and Yelp and Coinbase and dating apps to help them prevent abuse of their platform, whether it's abusive behavior, like, somebody creating a fake account on a dating site to like try to scam people, or somebody trying to take over someone's account to, you know, book an Airbnb or use a fake credit card. So they're trying to discourage and prevent fraud and kind of flag problem users.
So one of the things that I'm curious about when you were going through and looking at this data, you requested it, you saw 400 pages of information. Do these companies that are, at least up to this point, have been kind of shadowy and outside of the purview, do they list their clients? Can you go? I know you can go to some of them and ask for your data, but I'm more curious about, do they disclose which companies they're working with so that it gives the consumer a better idea of, hey, if I work with Airbnb, then I know that this company can also share that data with these companies across the spectrum.
Yeah, you know, I think overall that this tends to be covered in privacy policies by some kind of vague and generic statement that, you know, we share data with third parties to, you know, assess
services,
risk on the platform. Yeah, exactly. Improve services. And that you don't typically have a list of the companies that they've passed your data along to. So that is what's difficult about this industry. We're starting to have a little bit of transparency because of these new privacy laws, CCPA in California and the GDPR in Europe, that require, you know, the companies to be more transparent and share data about what they know about people. But the more frustrating thing is that we don't really know the universe of companies that are in this industry at this point. So there are a couple of different groups that are trying to list these out. I think that maybe the California privacy law is going to require companies like this to register. And so you would actually have like a directory that you could consult. But the way I targeted these companies is that they have been covered before in the press when the press has written about these secret scores, and they were named in a complaint that a consumer group sent to the Federal Trade Commission this summer, asking them to please investigate this industry because, you know, there could be abuse here, and it's not regulated in the way that credit bureaus, for example, are regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Okay, so that's actually what I was wanting to ask you next, is sort of why did you decide to open this and look into it? I think some people are kind of going, oh dear, I don't even want to think about that. But it's obviously, I feel it's very important that we look at this and sort of see how the sausage is made, as it were. Was it simply just the fact that you had seen these companies listed before, more so than a personal desire to kind of know how your data was out there? And then I guess my question is, if that was your original reason for doing so, when you found out with the one company having 400 pages, did that sort of inspire you to continue to look at the other companies? That at least would be how I would feel about it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I read this report from the Consumer Education Foundation, and I kind of thought, oh, is there a story here? I know that these companies have been written about before. How could I do something new with this? And any watchers of this show that are familiar with my work know maybe that I love doing first-person experiments. So, you know, turning my home into a smart home and measuring the privacy flows, living on Bitcoin, cutting the tech giants out of my life. So I thought, what's the first person thing I could do here? And it was, can I pierce the veil and see what this industry knows about me? And I approached all the companies at the same time, and it took about a month overall for me to get responses from the companies. And some, like Sift, were very forthcoming, and other ones really gave me the runaround, you know, and said, well, we can't give you the data. You have to go to the companies that use us and get your data from them. They wouldn't tell me what those companies are.
That's the part right there, right? So you mentioned in your article this company called Customer, and I was curious, and this article wasn't published too many days ago. It was November 4th, and so I assume that you still have, or you're still getting the runaround from Customer, or has this article being published helped speed along the process at all there?
Definitely not. Yeah, Customer basically said, you know, we're just a database. They said, you've incorrectly categorized us. We're more like a Salesforce or an Oracle. We're a database, and, you know, we're keeping this data on behalf of companies that they can see the timeline of how they've interacted with customers. But that was frustrating for me because, you know, I had gotten this 400-page report from Sift, and Sift could have made the same excuse, but Sift is choosing to be more transparent. So no, I haven't gotten anything from Customer. I haven't really heard from any of the companies since the piece came out, except for Sift. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I talked to them originally, I'd asked, have you gotten many requests for data since you created this new process? And they said, oh, we haven't seen much of a response. But since the article went out, they, on the very first day by lunchtime, they had already gotten 8,000 requests. And I'm sure it's many more since then. So it may take a little longer for people to get their reports than it took for my report to come in.
Yeah. In fact, the article was updated, I think, on November 5th to say that originally there was an online form that you could use on Sift's website. But since then, that page has been disabled and you have to email privacy@sift.com to get your information. So I think that I have to say, I personally love that you are looking into this, and that companies are sort of being brought out into the light, where maybe before, you know, this was something you were paying attention to, but the average person was not as much. And so being able to read through and say, okay, these are the different companies that are sort of collecting my data, and here's how to go about it. It seems like most of the time there's some sort of, it's privacy at this page, or activity at this page, or some email that you have to do. And I'm curious, first of all, with the California Consumer Privacy Act and, of course, the GDPR, are those laws helping to implement, or rather suggesting that a system like an online form be put in place versus just an email? Is there a more technical aspect to encouraging or requiring companies to share your data and make it easily accessible? And because sending an email, I don't see the average person sort of understanding, okay, I'm supposed to send an email to this, but what do I say in the email? What's the subject supposed to be? Is that changing at all with these laws?
Yeah, I don't know offhand whether the laws kind of have built into them exactly what the process needs to look like. I do know that there are a number of companies that are now entering the industry of helping companies comply with these laws.
Oh, wow.
So Zeta Global, for example, which they sent me basically half of my file. They sent me, they bought the company Discus a few years ago. And so the data they had on me were all of the comments that I had made on AboveTheLaw.com, which is a place where I used to be a blogger. But they didn't send me, they also do a lot of work around how valuable a customer is and how much money they have to spend. And that data they didn't send to me. They said they're essentially still setting up their data request portal and getting everything worked out, and that, you know, it won't be fully fledged and ready to go until January 1st, 2020, when the California Consumer Privacy Law goes into effect. But I do think, you know, a lot of the companies will end up setting up portals mm-hmm. just because I think it's overwhelming by email. And I also got a lot of emails from readers because I shared my email address in the article and invited them to tell me if they got anything weird in their files. And a lot of people just asked me, you know, what do I ask for? Mm-hmm. And all I did when I sent in my emails is I just said, I want all the data you have on me, which is a pretty simple way to put it.
That is simple. And then sometimes it results in 400 pages of data.
Right.
Now, I'm curious, was this sent as a link to a PDF you could download from somewhere? Or was this just an attachment? Because that's quite a big file. I mean, I know it's just text. Well, at least I assume it's just text, but that's still kind of a big PDF.
Yeah, I think that one came in as a text file attachment.
Interesting. Now, one of the things that you did here that I thought was kind of fun is that you actually encouraged somebody else to sort of take a first person approach to this data request policy. So I believe this is the director at the Consumer Education Foundation. You said, why don't you go ahead and reach out to these companies and see what data you can get back? And one of the things that came out of that, they said, I don't really care that these data analytics companies know I made a return to Victoria's Secret in 2009. And then it goes on, but how is this information being used against me when you generate scores for your clients? And so I think in some cases, talking to the average consumer, when you were explaining what data they have, they may have that apathy. I don't care that they know that I ate chicken kebabs, but it's this idea that I need to know how that information is being used. And so it brought up this question. When you've gotten the data from these different companies, do they also tell you the source of where their data is coming from along with it? Because if we don't know sort of the original source of where the data is coming from, we just know that this one company has gathered it from all these different places, we don't have all of the information we need. So did they, along with providing you the data they had on you, say, and this came from this company and this came from this company?
No. And Laura had some information come out that I didn't from some of the companies. Some of the companies said, I didn't have anything on you. So Laura was the co-author of that complaint I was talking about earlier to the FTC about this industry. But yeah, she Retail Equation, which determines whether people can make returns or not at a number of retailers, had only one entry for her that she bought three items to Victoria's Secret in 2009 worth $78. Another of these companies, Riskified, sent her information about a transaction she'd made. It had her address and her email address and a little bit more information, but it didn't say where the transaction was or what she had bought. And so it was just this kind of like raw data without any sense of where it came from or how the company had used that data. And I think a lot of people have especially experienced this with this company Retail Equation, where they've gone to Best Buy or to Victoria's Secret or Sephora and they tried to return an item and they said, no, sorry, you can't. Here's a rejection receipt with a number to call, and you call Retail Equation and they give you your file saying, well, you've made all these returns, so you're not allowed to make a return anymore. And they don't explain, you know, how they came to that conclusion. So that's a frustration in this process, is that we're getting the raw data, but they're not necessarily saying what decision they came to or why. SIFT, again, the 400-page report, they were an exception on many of the entries in that file. It said it had basically a percentage rating for whether this was likely to be fraud or not fraud, account takeover or not account takeover, abusive or not abusive. And so they actually did have scores in that file. But they are, even though they have gotten so much criticism since this came out because it was a 400-page file they sent me, they are the most transparent of the mm-hmm. companies that I dealt with, and they really gave me the most information.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And I encourage everyone to read the article, to sort of read what the chief executive of SIFT had to say about what they feel their responsibility is. Another point that you sort of come across here is the data that they're sharing with you in some companies' cases may only be the data that they are using to figure out how to calculate the score. So in the case of the retail, a retail equation, there could be a lot more data that they are getting via their pipes, but it's the data that they then take and use to calculate your score that they might be willing to share with you. So there's every opportunity, or there's every chance, that there's even more data being gathered by these companies that then you don't realize is being gathered. And instead of that, they sort of are getting to pick and choose what they show to you and what they use, which doesn't account. It's like the tip of the iceberg. There's a huge iceberg of data under the water that you don't get to see. Now, one of the other questions that I had for you is, what are some tips? So I think that you had a great tip there, simply in the email saying, what's all the data that you have on me? Do you have any other tips for folks that are looking to collect their data? Are there any companies maybe that you did not list in this article that they could also go to? And how does someone kind of, if they want to go crawling into this underground tunnel, what's the best way, I guess, of finding this information for themselves, hopefully so that it leads to more material for you? You did include your email in the article for particularly interesting things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best place to start is to go to the article and look at this list of companies and reach out to them. And then in general, like, if you come across a company for whatever reason that has been used to score you, the way to figure out how to get your data from them is to go to their privacy policy, which you probably have never looked at or read before. And I would just do Control F for requests. And that would usually get me to the part of their privacy policy where they talk about how they handle data requests. And usually it'll just say, like, email privacy@companyname.com, and that starts off the process for getting your data. But yeah, that's how it goes. Again, the challenging thing is to find the companies that are doing this kind of work, and people tend to come across them in lots of different ways, but usually you come across it when there's maybe an adverse decision that's been made about you. Like, mm-hmm. you went to Best Buy and tried to return a phone cover and they said, no, you can't. Here's your receipt. You need to call this company to find out why.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you, Kashmir, for joining us today. You absolutely need to go check out this article over on the New York Times. We'll include it in the show notes, but I bet if you just look up Consumer Score NYT, you're going to come across it. If people are wanting to follow you online, see your work, especially your first person dives into all of this stuff, where can they do so?
The best place to find me is NewYorkTimes.com, or I'm Cash Hill on Twitter.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up, I chat with Android Central's Daniel Bader about the new Echo Studio smart speaker. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by privacy.com. I am jazzed about having Privacy as one of our sponsors. You don't use the same password everywhere, so why would you use the same card number when you shop online? With privacy.com, you get a brand new virtual Visa or MasterCard card number for every purchase you make online with just one click. This service is seriously so great. I've been using this for years because I think that the idea of it is brilliant. Basically, it is a great way to track your purchases across multiple subscription services and make it super simple to keep track and get rid of services that you don't want to use anymore. Keep the ones that you do want to use. Everybody listening right now, you just need to go to privacy.com. You need to sign up and give it a try, because I promise you, once you start using it, you're like, how have I not used this before? This totally makes sense. So what you do is you go into privacy.com, you link up your account to the service, your funding account to the service. And then for all the different accounts that you have, you know, you have a subscription for Netflix, say, or Spotify, you go on there and you say, create a card. Okay, this one's going to be for Spotify. And you get a virtual card number that then you pop into Spotify. And then from that point forward, that card and Spotify are linked. And there's no other way for that card number to be charged. It can only be charged by Spotify. You can set up how much you want it to be charged per year. You can make it so that it's a burner card, so to speak, meaning that it has one time to go and then it's done. You can pause a card at any time. You can remove a card when you want to. And so this means that if one of your services that you're using, one of your subscription services, or maybe you want to make a payment for a site that you're like, man, I really want to buy that refrigerator part because my refrigerator is broken, but this site seems kind of sketchy and I don't know if I'm running the risk of having my data stolen. Well, you set up a privacy card. It's only going to work with that site. If that site ever got breached, that card is compromised, but your actual main card, your bank account, not breached. It's safe. This is why privacy is so great. I can't speak enough about how everybody just needs to try the doggone service. So there is an extension for Chrome. You can also get the Android or iOS app, and you can go to the website and create it very easily. And then you link those virtual cards, like I said, to your US checking account or debit card, and you can set those spending limits per charge, per month, or per year. So that means that if you are signing up for a service and you want to make sure that if that service was to change, you know, if it goes from $9.99 a month to $12.99 a month, it's not going to automatically charge you $12.99, because privacy will step in there and say, no, you set the card so that $10 is the most it's going to be charged, and it will stop that. You never have to worry about being billed twice. You don't have to worry about being upgraded without your consent. You don't need to worry about forgetting to cancel your subscriptions or free trials. And refunds work even if you decide to close or pause the card because you're done using it, or you just want to make sure that things are working. Those refunds are still going to come to you. Now, most importantly, the security of your data is at the core of what privacy does. Your virtual cards are locked to a merchant. So, as I mentioned before, you don't have to worry about changing your card everywhere if one gets hacked. You'll get a decline email or a push notification if a hacker does try to use the card elsewhere. So you have it linked to Spotify and then suddenly someone's trying to make a purchase at Whole Foods. Not going to happen. You're going to get a notification about it. And they're PCI DSS compliant, held to the same security standards as your bank. Sensitive information is secured using military-grade encryption. And information is encrypted using split-key encryption with partial keys held by separate employees. Currently, on their free personal plan, you can create up to 12 cards a month. That's, again, secure, merchant locked, and single use. And now Privacy has just launched two paid versions, Pro and Teams. For Pro, it's $10 a month. You get access to everything that is included in the free personal plan. Plus, you get 1% cash back on all purchases. And it gives you 36 cards a month and more security and privacy features. The Teams account, that's for those who own a small business or in charge of a team, $25 per month. And you get access to everything included in the Pro version. Plus, a dedicated account manager, access to 60 cards a month, and transaction limits tailored to your business needs. Privacy believes customers should have full control of their data, so they provide their customers access to transaction data via a webhook API. We were just talking about how important it is to have access to your data. That's great. And of course, they've got two-factor authentication, which you should be signing up for. So protect your privacy and your money with virtual cards from privacy.com. To learn more and get a $5 credit off your first purchase, visit privacy.com/TNW. That's privacy.com/TNW. Don't forget to check out their Pro or Team versions as well. Seriously, if you're not going to privacy.com/TNW right now, I don't know why. You should go check it out. Just give it a try and see how helpful it is to be reminded, oh yeah, I do have 9, 10, 15, 20 different subscription services. It helps keep track of that. And if you decide you need to get rid of one, then it's very easy to do. And it's even better for those pesky subscription services where you're trying to get them canceled, but they make you call and they put you through to 12 different people and you just wish that they would let you cancel and you can't do it. You just hit delete on that card and they can't charge you even if they wanted to. Pretty great for that. So check out that at privacy.com/TNW. All right, folks. Amazon has entered into the premium smart speaker market. It's been making smart speakers for ages, but the Amazon Echo Studio is a new product on the scene. And I have the delightful Daniel Bader here from Android Central to talk with me about his review, A Sonic Boom for Your Living Room. Hello, Daniel Bader.
Hello, Micah Sargent. Oh, so good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. See, it's weird. I'm calling you Daniel, but everybody that I know, we all know you as Bader. So that's, I'm getting used to it.
You can call me Bader. It's a differentiator. Nobody knows me as, there aren't that many Baders. There are many, many, many Daniels.
So. Yes, but none like you. And we appreciate you joining us today. So let's talk about the Amazon Echo Studio. I guess, first of all, what is your overall take on this device? And do you want to explain a little bit about what it is in the first place? Because Amazon has lots of different Echo devices that are smart speakers that you can communicate with Alexa. So what makes this one different? Why does it get that studio moniker on the end?
Yeah, so I mean, I just have to preface this by saying right before I came on, I realized, like, I was like, you were just finishing the ad read, and I was like, oh no, I didn't mute the studio so that if I say the Alexa word, it's all going to go haywire and start talking to me, and I don't want that. So that is the first part, right? This is a smart speaker that you can talk to. It has 7 microphones on the top, and it does the same thing that all of your other Echo speakers do. It just does it louder, and it does it with much, much better and fuller sound. It has 3 mid-range tweeters. It has a dedicated high treble tweeter that faces you, and the 3 mid-range tweeters face in 3 separate directions, plus a downward firing woofer for that really, rumbly bass. Ooh. And the one thing that I think Amazon has tried to do and hasn't done super well until the last year is high fidelity sound. They dipped their toe a little bit with the subwoofer last year that you could pair to the less powerful Echo speakers. And they have these Link and Link Amp products that you can connect to your existing stereo that would allow you to talk to, I'm going to call her Lexi. And then then you can hook it up to your regular stereo and get good sound with smart add-on. But this is the first kind of all-in-one hi-fi stereo that competes with the HomePod and with the Google Home Max. And it works. It's a really good product, and it undercuts basically everything out there by a lot. And I think that's really the big takeaway here is it sounds good and it's way, way cheaper than a HomePod or a Google Home Max.
Okay. Yeah. So this is for folks who want to have that more premium sound, but maybe aren't looking to spend that extra cost. Now, how well does it work as an addition to your already maybe Echo-filled home? Is this meant to be sort of a standout product, or does it integrate well with the others as part of the ability to walk into any room and say, Alexa, I want you to do this. Or, I like what you said, Lexi, I want to be able to do this. Is it buy this and be done with it, or is it a good idea to bring it into my home as an addition to the other Echo devices that I have?
So I think Amazon recognizes that a lot of its products are shoved into the corners of rooms that where people just ask them very kind of high level questions, play this on Spotify or set a timer or whatever. And they're seeing, a lot of Echo Dots in kitchens. They're seeing a lot of Echo, Echo Show, the smaller Echo displays, the spots in bedrooms. But they didn't really have anything to compete with the big sounding Sonos and HomePod type speakers in the living room. Mm-hmm. The Echo Plus, even though the word plus is in there, it's still a fairly fairly small physical speaker, and it doesn't have the bass to really kick off a party. And it was this product that Amazon was missing compared to its competitors, right? Like, you've heard the HomePod. The HomePod is a diminutive product that really can just push out a whole lot of music. The Google Home Max, it is a physically massive product, on the other hand, and it just fills a room with sound, overwhelmingly often with bass. This product is a really nice, middle ground. It pushes beautiful mid-range. The vocals coming out of it are really precise. It does not overwhelming bass, but really kind of accurate bass.
Ooh, that's good.
And overall, it just feels like a product that Amazon spent a year or two getting right before announcing it.
Ah, okay. Now, one of the things, I don't know if you had a chance to see this on Twitter, but one of my favorite, these days especially, one of my favorite follows on Twitter is Chrissy Teigen. And Teigen had posted this hilarious video not too long ago with one of those giant Google Home Max things, and there's some kid's song playing on it, and it's very loud, and she's shouting at this device. She's mere inches from it, shouting at it to try to get it to turn down the volume. And so she's saying the trigger word, "Hey, you boo-boo," and it's not actually listening to her. So one of the things about Amazon that they've been doing since the beginning is this idea that the microphones they've got, these beam-forming microphones, are so good that they, and I don't know if they still do this, but for a while they would sell third-party companies a microphone array chip that they could put into their devices to make it Lexi-enabled and to also give it the really high-quality microphone system. With this very loud sonic boom for your living room, does it still hold up in terms of being able to hear you well, despite the fact that music is playing loudly?
Yes, I will say, so I did the shout test, as I like to call it. It works. It's better than the Google Home Max. It is, I don't know if it's better than other Lexi speakers, but it should be just as good. The problem is you can't really compare apples to apples, because this gets so much louder than the other ones, that it's really difficult. But at the loudest volume in my living room, this heard me from across the room say the hot word. So that was really impressive. And you're correct. Amazon has always been a market leader when it comes to beam-forming microphones and being able to cut out and cancel a lot of the other noise, including the music that's playing from the speaker itself, in order to hear the hot word. So, this is a really interesting product. The interesting part of it is also something that I haven't mentioned. It's being marketed as a 3D sound Dolby Atmos type product.
Oh.
And in fact, that is the part of the system that fails to impress. And in fact, it's something that I suggest people, when they get it, turn off immediately in order to get access to the really good fundamentals of the speaker system.
Okay, can you explain a little bit more about this Dolby Atmos 3D sound? What is this comparable to other systems? So for example, HomePod, you can pick it up and put it somewhere else, and then the microphones that are inside will hear how close it is to walls and then adjust the sound to better make an overall sound, whatever, based on where it's been placed. Is that what this is, or is this something completely different? And what's going on here? Why do we want to turn it off?
Right. So this is, the studio does have that feature where you plunk it down on the floor and it sends out, it uses its microphones to detect ambience and echo and decides how to tweak the EQ slightly. Mm-hmm. And it works. It does sound a little different if you shove it in the corner than if you have it on a table in the middle of your room. Not drastically, but it does sound a little different. This is not that. This is using the three directional tweeters to give you a simulation of what Amazon is calling 3D sound. And what it attempts to do is give you this 360 degree, omni-oral experience where you basically can hear different parts of the song depending on where you are in the room. Now, the reason this has that feature is because Amazon Music HD has a very, very small collection of tracks that have been explicitly remastered for this sound format. So okay. It is a proprietary 3D audio sound format. And when you listen to music that has been optimized for the speaker, the array that it is, it sounds great. But by default, the studio so-called upmixes all stereo content to 3D omnimural sound. And what it does is it ends up crushing the mids to the point where you can barely hear the vocals. And I didn't realize that it had it turned on by default until I dug into the settings after I had a terrible first impression of this thing. I had some people over for dinner. I was like, okay, we're going to do a direct comparison between this and the Google Home Max. Every single person in the room hated the sound coming out of the studio. And it was only then that I dug into it and was like, okay, that's why. It's because this thing is on by default. It makes no sense to me why Amazon would enable this by default. And I really hope they choose to disable it when they ship it. Uh-huh. That's actually shipping today. But if they release a software update, I hope that they make that decision.
Wow. So that's pretty incredible. When you turned it off, then you felt better about it. I had heard about the HD stuff, and I didn't realize now that they've got some remastered tracks. But yeah, anybody who cares a little bit about their TV settings knows about upscaling in terms of video and how that can make for a pretty atrocious experience. So I'm not surprised that upmixing, as it's called, makes it a poor experience here. Another question, and I know you touched a little bit on this, but I noticed when I got the Echo Buds, I was having some trouble getting them to pair with devices that were not the iPhone that had the Lexi app on it. And When I went online on Amazon's site to look for the user manual, essentially, to figure out how to do the pairing process, Amazon, they had just come out, and so Amazon had not yet updated the support documents to include this information. So I was kind of stuck for a few days until the official release date to be able to figure out how to do that. So right now, I've been seeing a little bit of conversation in the chat about this question as well. There's not a whole lot of information about what the Echo Studio can or can't pair to. Does the Echo Studio pair with an Echo Sub? Does it let you do stereo pairing with a second studio? What is the whole pairing experience here?
So yes and yes. I've only paired it to a sub. I can't vouch for the stereo pairing, but mm-hmm. I believe that is it uses the same process. What Amazon has done is created the ability to form groups in its app. And once you assign these two products that technically can work together in the same group, they just pair, and they won't work with any other product until you unpair them. So it is it's sort of like you are fusing them together as a when two become one, Spice Girls style.
Yes.
I paired it to my Echo Sub and it worked great. There aren't a lot of settings, so I can't set the crossover frequency like I would be able to on, say, some more hi-fi products. Mm-hmm. But, this is a wireless solution, and I guess Amazon just wants this to be as plug-and-play as possible. So that's kind of understandable.
Yeah, another thing that it includes with it is the Zigbee hub built in, or it has Zigbee support, which that has kind of been mostly relegated to the Echo Plus in the past. So it's interesting to see they're continuing to try to make their more premium devices work well with the home. In your testing with it, did you do any sort of smart home control, or did you mostly just use this as a music listening device?
So I didn't pair anything new to it because I've already done the pairing with my Echo Plus, but the discovery mechanism is really simple. I mean, it really does just take you either saying Lexi, discover new devices, or you go into the app and you let it do it for you. Anything Zigbee compatible just was discovered. I've only done it with Hue light bulbs before, but it really is quite intuitive. The problem, and I don't think this is unique to Amazon, but the problem is when you have a smart home full of products. Mm-hmm. So I have upwards of a dozen smart lights. I have, you know, a bunch of smart locks and I have a bunch of sensors and things like that. It can get really overwhelming to administer all of these products independently. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you know this. It's really not intuitive, and neither Amazon nor Google nor any of these consolidators have figured it out. And you know, the reliance on using voice rather than digging into the app means that most of the, like, doing it easily is not the same as doing it well, because you want to be able to do it easily and well with the app. But the only way to do it easily and well is sort of with your voice, which is sort of counterintuitive. So not a huge fan of administering my smart home with Amazon in general. I think Google actually does a much better job. But, and I actually think Apple does the best job, but not everything is compatible with HomeKit.
Right. So yeah, which is unfortunate. And speaking to that, I moved from my lovingly set up smart home in Missouri to California, and I've been here since the end of July, and I have yet to completely reset up my smart home because it's a process and I don't have time for the process that it takes. So I don't have control of my smart home via Amazon stuff yet, despite the fact that I really do enjoy the control that Lexi provides there as much as I do enjoy the HomeKit stuff. So yeah, I'm with you there that process can be just getting everything right and getting everything how you want it. I guess the one other thing that I would love for you to share with folks is when this product, because I'm seeing on Amazon's website right now, it's not showing that it'll be in stock until December 10th, but you said it launches today?
Yeah, it goes on sale today. So I guess it was so popular, they either had no stock, which is sometimes what Amazon does. Mm-hmm. They just don't create enough of the product. Or it was so successful that they are only going to get new stuff in stock next month, which is bonkers if you think about it, because this thing has been on pre-order for, I want to say, since September 15th or mm-hmm. whenever the Amazon event was. Like, it's been over, it's been nearly 2 months. I think this is a pretty popular product. My assumption here is that they sold more than they thought, and they just didn't have enough in stock to make up for it. It's a really impressive speaker and solution for the bigger rooms in your house, and it costs just $200.
Excellent. And in fact, when you buy an Echo Studio for the $200 that you mentioned, you get if you're in a region that supports it, a 90-day free trial of Amazon Music HD. So they really want you to try out this 3D music stuff. So they give you 90 days to give it a go and hopefully get hooked on it, I assume is what they would like. That was, my last question there was the $200 was the price point there, which does undercut so many of the other things. And for folks, I mean, do you see this? I guess the last thing I'll ask is, so many of the other products in this space seem to be more often directed at those of us who pay a little bit more attention to tech. Do you think that the Echo Studio falls into still the nerdy area, or is this more of a product that a more average consumer would be into? And is that Amazon's doing? Do you think that it's, specific to Echo familiarity, or do you think that that is just the price point?
It's a really good question, Micah, and I'm not sure. So here, let me give you sort of some context, and the same context that I was thinking about when I reviewed this. My favorite smart speaker that I recommend to everybody is the Sonos One. It's much smaller than the Echo Studio. It's much better designed. It looks beautiful. Amazon, for all of its benefits, and, you know, from a price perspective, it still does not know how to nail design. And I will argue that till the cows come home. I don't think that the Studio is a very nicely designed product. I think that it's functional, it's utilitarian. It's okay if you hide it in your corner and just listen to the music that comes out of it. But for so long, the $200 price point for me has always been the Sonos One, which is a smart speaker that supports both Lexi and Google Assistant interchangeably if you want. Now, this sounds better than that. So I'm going to tell people, if you don't need the Google stuff, just get this because it does objectively sound better. At the same time, if you are willing to spend $200 on a smart speaker, are you willing to spend $400 on a smart speaker or $500? And what I mean is, are you going for the intelligence or are you going for the fidelity? And in that case, do you even need a smart speaker? Should you buy a Sonos Play 5, for instance, which is $500? I know, completely different, and people are going to be like, what are you even saying right now? But there's a gulf between the $120 Echo Plus, the $100 Echo, which both sound fine. Something like the Echo Show, which is $230 and also sounds really good. And it's not clear to me, are people going to buy this even if they already have Echo products?
Right.
Because
that's my
question. It's a much better sounding speaker, but it's not ideal for every part of the house. It's really only ideal for those larger rooms like the living room that you need that extra oomph and you may be listening with a lot more people. You know what? I don't really know how many people are going to jump on this as opposed to spending a little bit more on an even better speaker that may not be smart, but maybe a powered speaker like a Sonos that, you know, has much better sound. And I compared this to the Sonos Play 5, and that thing still wipes the floor with the Echo Studio and every other smart speaker out there, including the HomePod. So I'm not sure, but I think that if you are willing to spend a bit more than the other Echo products and you want better sound, this is the best smart speaker in its price range, period.
All right. As long as you turn off that 3D option, that up
yes,
what do you call it? Upscaling,
up mixing.
Oh no. I don't like that.
I had a draft of my review that called it upchucking, 3D upchucking.
That's how it's going to be in my heart from now on. Yeah.
I decided against it, Micah.
Oh, well, every time I see up mixing, I will be automatically, my brain will automatically edit that into upchucking. So thank I appreciate you. That. Daniel Bader, thank you so much for being here today. It was a delight. If people would like to follow you online and see your work, where can they do that?
Well, I'm at Journey Dan. It's a journeyman with a D on all the things, Instagram, Twitter. I think I don't use Facebook, so just those two. And AndroidCentral.com. I'll throw in a plug for iMore because we both love and appreciate iMore and the people there. So and all the Sonos content that you want is on iMore. So if you're interested in learning more about that stuff, go to either one.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being here, and we'll speak soon.
All right, Micah. Thanks again.
Bye, Bader. Up next, I share my story of the week, and it's all about your face. Well, your face, my face, everyone's face. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by RingCentral. RingCentral is the number one global cloud phone system that does pretty much everything. RingCentral allows your business to have effortless communication. It's great for when you're on the go. You can work remotely and manage your business from your mobile device by seamlessly switching between desktop and mobile without dropping a call. You can route calls, you can have video conferences, you can utilize team messaging, you can even do online fax, because yes, the fact is sometimes you still have to send faxes. You can integrate with all of your favorite apps as well. That includes Gmail, our friends at Zapier, Salesforce, Microsoft Outlook, and more. Plus, retrieve voicemail, which also has a transcription feature. I think this is great. Someone sends you a voicemail. Maybe you're in the middle of something else. You're in a meeting and you need to make sure that whatever that call was about is not so important that you need to step out of the meeting. You don't have to listen to it while you're in the meeting. You can just quickly read through the transcript if you want to. I think that's pretty great for that. And as well as when we have people send in questions and things like that via audio, to be able to have that transcription there. It's the solution that grows with you and your company because it makes it super simple to easily add additional users, like when Aunt Pruitt and I were added to the RingCentral system here at Twit. Now, RingCentral is more than just a phone system. You may know it as a phone system, but it will simplify your workflow so you can connect easily with customers and employees, giving you effortless service. With any mode, on any device, anywhere, their app provides flawless integration, letting you transition from your personal phone to your computer during a call. Yes, so you can start on your phone, you hop into the office, and switch to your computer very easily. So no matter where you are, it's ready for you. Now, RingCentral's app is ahead of its time because it lets you send business SMS from your personal phone. You don't even have to transfer your contacts into the app. It automatically populates them for you. And they even let you port existing numbers over from other services. So maybe you're on a different service right now and you're like, man, I really would like to switch to RingCentral. But there's going to be this whole process where I have to figure out, do I get a new number and send it out to clients? What do I do here? No, you can port it over, no problem. RingCentral is the complete communication solution from one vendor and starts as low as $19.99, saving you money and cutting your phone costs by at least 30%. They also have customer service 24/7 via telephone, live chat, and email if you need them. And of course, we here at Twit have the RingCentral service, as I mentioned. I think it was Leo who said, one of the best things we can say about RingCentral is the fact that we use it here, and many of our employees don't even realize that we use it here. That's how good it is. It's seamless, it's right out of the way, and it's perfect. But even more than that is the fact that if you are a person who's in charge of figuring out how your company is going to communicate, maybe you're setting up a new company or you're trying to figure out what's next for how your growing business is going to stay in touch. Well, you might be thinking, okay, I've got to get a phone service. I need to figure out my online faxing. I need to figure out all of these different things. I need to figure out how we're going to chat during the day. Well, instead of having to reach out to all these different services and get them signed up and get everybody on them, you just get RingCentral because it's got it all. When you sign up today, you're going to get instant access to RingCentral's award-winning powerful phone system with text, fax, video conferencing, and more. Take advantage of their special holiday bundle offer for Tech News Weekly's audience only, and don't pay until 2020 when you go to ringcentral.com/TNW. That's ringcentral.com/TNW. Thanks so much, RingCentral. And now it's time to talk about my story of the week. So with Jason out, it's just me here, folks. And my story is from Medium's 1.0 publication by Dave Gershkorn, who has been on the show before. I was hoping to get him on the show to talk about this article, actually, but he is he's traveling right now. And so instead, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to let this story just slide by. We've got to talk about it. This is an exclusive on Medium's 1.0, and it talks about the U.S. military's massive facial recognition system. So 1.0 obtained some documents that show how the military captures biometric data around the world. And in fact, it says it's packed with millions of images of faces, irises, fingerprints, and DNA data. It's a biometric dragnet of anyone who has come in contact with the U.S. military abroad. 7.4 million identities in the database. And this is controlled by the Defense Forensics and Biometrics Agency, the DFBA. And the database itself is known as the Automated Biometric Information System. Now, in these documents obtained by 1.0, this is what some of the quotes include. Denying our adversaries anonymity allows us to focus our lethality. It's like ripping the camouflage netting off the enemy ammunition dump. This is Glenn Kreise, the director of the Defense Forensics and Biometrics Agency. This database is filled with loads of all sorts of biometric data, and to have access to this, the documents here is pretty incredible. Of course, the Department of Defense has contracted a lot of this information out to be able to gather this data and to hold on to it. And it is, I mean, it not only details sort of how these processes are put into place, but also includes information about the contracts and how much money is being spent on this. So this is a ridiculous amount of information that gives a good look into one of the ways that the Defense Department is keeping track of not just enemies around the world, but also pretty much folks who have had any contact with our military and how to keep track of those folks. So if you head over to 10, of course, we will include a link in the show notes to check it out. But an exclusive piece, how the U.S. military's massive facial recognition system works. It is quite an eye-opener, I will say. With Jason Howell out, I thought that it would be a good idea to talk about some of the other shows you should catch this week on Twit. On Monday, Jason Howell and I covered the Microsoft Ignite event. This was Satya Nadella's time to come out. It's called the Vision Keynote. Comes out on stage and talks about what Microsoft is going to be doing in the coming year. In years past, this event was the beginning of the event, at least, was mostly focused on the intangible nature of what Microsoft was going to be doing in the coming year. So it was big on, we're growing, we are expanding, we're doing this, and it's full of buzzwords. But now, as Mary Jo Foley pointed out just yesterday on Windows Weekly, it looks to be that they're trying to turn Microsoft Ignite into a bit of a conference that is like AWS, that's Amazon Web Services conference. And so now there's more tangible stuff. So check that out. If you didn't get a chance to see the Microsoft Ignite event, if that's something that you're interested in, there was lots of cloud computing information, lots about AI, and as Satya Nadella loves to say, a lot about tech intensity. So check that out if you're looking for our attempt at color commentary for an event that is mostly focused on big business and server technology. On Tuesday, Rosemary Orchard joined me on iOS Today to talk about writing on iOS, and hands down, 1,000%, I am telling you, you've got to see this episode. Rosemary Orchard, she was fantastic. So she was going to talk about her process for writing and, you know, blogging and what all that involves. But on top of just being excellently prepared with everything that we needed in that I asked to have in the show notes, Rosemary made it so that she could show her iPad on screen despite coming in remote. And so you're going to get just this fantastic inside look at some of the best apps for writing on iOS. So if you do any sort of writing, idea generation, or you are just looking at a way to, of course, this is National Novel Writing Month, if you're looking at a way to sort of handle that process, or if you blog, even if you send tweets, you've got to check out this this episode. It really was incredible having Rosemary Orchard on, and so I thank her for that. And then the last plug we have here is that Triangulation, we've got a new episode tomorrow with the John Hodgman himself. Judge John Hodgman wrote a new book called Medallion Status. And this is a book about sort of stepping out of fame and coming to terms with the fact that you may not be as recognizable as you once were, or even if you're still recognizable in certain areas, you're just not at the same level of fame you were, and what that means, and sort of how you deal with that, how you handle it when you're no longer a medallion status member of society. It's a really hilarious book. It's a really insightful book. And the conversation that Mr. Hodgman and I had was pretty great as well, that involved discussions of the oxidization of the egg yolk inside of an egg and what that has to do with the lounge inside of certain airport terminals. That may be confusing, but you've just got to check it out. Thank you all for joining us. Of course, Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go to subscribe to the show in audio and video format. So you just go to twit.tv/TNW. It's got links to all the different places that you can subscribe, be it Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts, or if you want to watch the YouTube video and subscribe there, that's how you can do that. And of course, you can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv and follow us all on social media. That's at twit.tv. Again, twit.tv on Instagram, or at twit on Twitter. And of course, as I regularly mention, you've got to check out twit.community. It's literally just twit.community. That's the website where you can sign up and become part of our forums. And there have been some great conversations there that take place after an episode is published. A topic pops up on there. And so if you're not able to tune in live, then you can go ahead and check out the show afterward and leave your thoughts as you want to. If you want to tweet at me, you can do that at Micah Sargent. And of course, you can find Jason Howell at Jason Howell on Twitter. I think he's the Jason Howell on Instagram. I can't remember. He always gripes about me getting to have Micah Sargent on all of the social media. But definitely check him out on Twitter, and there might be links to his Instagram there. Thanks to John, Burke, John, and Sarah. Yes, that's two different Johns. And we thank you for your hard work on this show and making sure everything runs smoothly. And I am particularly thankful to you for helping me do this episode on my own today. And of course, also to Jason Howell, who helped me out with the process as well. Shout out to him, and we look forward to his return. We will see you next time on Tech News Weekly.